Hello, you, and welcome to You Are Good, a feelings podcast about movies. Today, we are talking about The Virgin Suicides, and we're talking about The Virgin Suicides with Suze Kempner. I am one of your hosts, Alex Steed, and I will soon be joined by my marvelous co-host, Sarah Marshall. The Virgin Suicides is a 1999 American psychological romantic drama film written and directed by Sofia Coppola in her feature directorial debut. It stars James Woods, Kathleen Turner, Kirsten Dunst, AJ Cook, Josh Harnett, Scott Glenn, and more. It is based on The Virgin Suicides by Jeffrey Eugenides. And if you want to hear a great conversation about the book, which I definitely listened to in preparation for this episode, listen to our great friend Caroline O'Donohue talk about the book over on Sentimental Garbage. Great chat. Loved it. Thought about that chat for days afterward. Suze Kempner is an English stand-up comedian, actress, and singer. She's great. We have had Suze on before where we talked about another Kirsten Dunst movie. We talked about Drop Dead Gorgeous. And I am just a huge fan of Suze. Glad that she's back. Hope that she comes back in the future as well. Hope that Suze just keeps coming back. We love her. She's also Doom in Doctor Who's Doomsday, which is, this is Doctor Who royalty on our very show. To those of you who are new to You Are Good, a feelings podcast about movies, the show operates the way the title suggests. We are not film critics. We watch movies and we say, here's what this makes me think about. Here's what this makes me feel. And here's how I feel about those feelings. That's what we're doing here. And it's always a fun time, or at least a thoughtful time, maybe a little bit of both, fun and thoughtful. So thank you so much for being here, new folks. And I'm always happy to reintroduce the concept to people who've been listening for a very long time. How are you doing? What's going on in your world? How are you feeling? What are you thinking about? I live in Los Angeles part-time. I live in the Central Valley of California, the other part of the time. But I'm making the full move this week. So my brain is so many members of the You Are Good team right now are all in the process of moving, and our brains are cooked. So thank you for bearing with me as my my rickety brain does its does exactly what is happening right now. I would love to make some suggestions to you about like what to do or read or consider, but all I've been doing lately is watching reruns of Gossip Girl. Nope, not even that. See, there it goes again. But all I've been doing lately is watching The OC. So I could recommend that if that's your cup of tea. Actually, I did not know it would be my cup of tea. And I was a little hesitant up front because I was like, this is more polite than Gossip Girl. So I don't know how I feel about it. But it is great. Love it. Adam Brody, killing it. Anyway, let us know how you're doing. We're at You Are Good or You Are Good Pod on social media, depending on whatever channel you're using or you're on. You can find us there. And don't forget that you, my friend, are good. Thank you so much for being here. We're so glad to have you. You Are Good, a feelings podcast about movies, is made possible with and by your support. Thanks so much to everyone who supports us on Patreon and Apple Podcast subscriptions. You got bonus episodes in exchange for that support. We truly appreciate you. We truly could not do this without you. We have all sorts of bonus content coming out in the next month. And you can experience it. You can consume it. You can put it in your ears by subscribing if you're not doing that already. And in doing so, you help make the show possible because we can't do it without your support. Few content warnings for this episode. Yes, we talk about suicide in our conversation about The Virgin Suicides. It comes up a lot in the movie. It's a huge plot point regularly throughout the movie. And we also talk about disordered eating. So please know about those two content warnings. And this will be a heavy episode overall because we talk about all sorts of things that are difficult to deal with in adolescence. And, you know, hey, if we're being honest, difficult to deal with now. If you are a supporter of Ceasefire, as I am, please look up actions to get involved in your neighborhood or your city or wherever. I'm sure you can find some if you haven't participated already. And if you were looking for a way to support materially right now, please get in touch with the folks at Palestine Children's Relief Fund. We will have a link to them and their services in the show notes. All right, I think that's it for this introduction, this meandering introduction to this week's episode of You Are Good, a Feelings podcast about movies. We appreciate you. Again, it's so true. So glad that we're able to do this, and we're only able to do this because you keep showing up for it. So thank you for continuing to show up for it. We are grateful. All right, let's get into it. Let's talk about The Virgin Suicides with Suze Kempner. Hello, Sarah Marshall.
Hello, Alex Steed.
How does one say hello in Virgin Suicides?
The '70s. we were saying hello even back then, if you can believe it.
I don't even know how to engage. This is such a unique movie. I don't even know how to engage it through pithy banter.
Oh, there's no pith. Here's some pithiness you can do, though. Have you ever watched a movie directed by the teenage girl whose dad forced her to be in his stupid movie, and everyone blamed her as if she had written the goddamn thing? And then she grew up and she made her own movie about what it's like to be a teenage girl. Have you seen that one?
I have seen that one. I only recently realized, and I at this point don't know where facts live and if the ones that I have are the true ones, but is it true?
Yes.
That Winona Ryder was who he was trying to have in The Godfather 3?
No, she was originally going to do it, and then she had to drop out because, you know, the life of Winona Ryder, I think, was too overwhelming to allow for her to be in The Godfather Part 3, which, by the way, that movie had problems, no matter who played that part, but we digress.
We got this as a result of how things went down, and I'm grateful for that.
We could have gotten, you don't have to be in your dad's terrible movie to direct a good movie when you grow up.
Well, we watched The Virgin Suicides, and we watched it because we are joined by the fabulous Suze Kempner. Suze, hello.
Hello. Thank you.
Hello. Thank you so much for coming back.
Thank you so much for having me. And thank you for allowing me to say my favorite bit about the Sofia Coppola starring in Godfather 3 story, which is the person who called Francis Ford Coppola days before filming was supposed to start was Winona Ryder's elderly boyfriend, Johnny Depp. So it's nice that he was looking out for her.
Oh,
and he said she can't do the movie. She's not well. She can't do the movie. Now, she probably wasn't well, but I do blame him.
Yeah.
I think he did it.
I love that. Wino forever.
Her elderly boyfriend. Yeah. That's fantastic. Suze, there were a bunch of options about movies that you could bring to us. What put The Virgin Suicides at the top of your list?
I love your podcast, and so it always seems to hit me when you will revisit a film that I saw between the ages of about 13 and 17. And I saw Virgin Suicides when I was 14 at the cinema in 99. And when they said, I remember watching it, and when they said, they say all the ages of the sisters, and they say Lux was 14, I was like, oh, I'm 14, I'm just like Kirsten Dunst in Virgin Suicides. And it's a funny one. It really stuck with me, and I had the VHS of it, and then I had the DVD of it. I had the soundtrack from it. And it's a film that, as I get older, ages with me. And I think all my favorite films from that era are films that I can revisit now and go, oh, yeah, it's just as good. It's just I'm older now.
I haven't seen this since then. And then I lived with this movie afterward in the form and shape of the Air soundtrack for years. Mm-hmm. Or like it, with Air general. Every time I listened to Air, Air had a big moment after this came out for a couple of years. And every time I listened to them, yes, I associated it with the movie. And I knew it was special, but I don't think I understood how it was special. And it was really tremendous watching it this go and knowing that I'm going to have the opportunity to talk with y'all about it, because this does so many fascinating things. Like, for a movie about five girls, it's about a bunch of boys' memories of five girls, which is a really fascinating take. And there's all sorts of things that happen that I'm thrilled about. Sarah, what was your relationship with this? What is your relationship with this, Ben?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so I was also a teenage, tweenage girl at the turn of the millennium. And I don't really know when, if I read the book or saw the movie first. They're both kind of knitted together for me at also like around the age of 14. But this movie was on IFC in 2002 a lot, which is a big marker of whether I grew up watching something and it was formative for me. And I remember reading the book a few times in high school. And at least at the time, it felt like one of the only things that allowed for the reality that it was just horrible to be an adolescent girl. And not necessarily understanding all the reasons why, but just kind of like allowing space for that. Because there even sort of stuff in the positive realm that was meant for girls at the time was, I think, often trying to be like, it's great. You just got to work hard and live to your potential and believe in yourself. And wow, your life is going to be nice. And it's like, what if you're just trying to survive this hormonal storm and the best you can do is just kind of live through it? And you need someone to acknowledge that surviving that period of your life can be extremely difficult, or else it makes you feel even crazier than usual. And that's what I think of when I think of both the book by Jeffrey Eugenides and the movie by Sofia Coppola.
Sarah, are you in a place where you're able to walk us through the dream?
Oh, sure. I mean, so basically this is, in the book, it's narrated by a collective we, which is the first time I had ever seen that narrative device, where you have, like, the narrator is always referring to we and to different boys in this group of neighborhood boys who are obsessed with the Lisbon sisters, but you never get an individual speaking for himself. It's just sort of a pack of teenage boys. And basically, it's a story of how these neighborhood boys became fixated on this family with two strict parents and five sisters, each more beautiful than the last, the second to youngest being Kirsten Dunst, whose character's name is Lux Lisbon. And how, starting with the youngest sister, Cecilia, who attempts suicide and then reattempts it and dies at a party that her parents have thrown for her, the parents clamp down on the girl's ability to interact with the world more and more. Josh Hartnett gets involved. And
there's a whole phase of cinema history where just Josh Hartnett would get involved.
Yeah, he just shows up. He's got some puka shells on. You're like, okay, you know, and it's these neighborhood boys watching these girls from afar, trying to piece together their lives and having actually almost no direct interaction with them. And then ending in a scene where the boys come over, they're kind of flirting with the idea of, let's get on the road, let's run away. And then the girls all choose that moment to all die by suicide together. Mm. And it's just, it really, it pairs in a way very well with The Iron Claw, because it's just about the unsurvivability of girlhood as these girls know it. Mm. And it also kind of, as a film, as I'm pretty sure the first feature film by Sofia Coppola, it's, you know, the teenage girls that I grew up with and was one of, and then kind of have met in adulthood who are from the same age group. Like, there's a real affinity for this movie and the way that I think it sort of has found this very beautiful melancholy aesthetic to, I think, make it bearable for us to get as deep into this story as we have to go.
How was it revisiting, Suze?
I don't think I've seen it in over a decade, maybe like 15 years. Mm. And the thing that struck me the most was, I used to see Kathleen Turner's character, she's the mother, mm-hmm. as sort of weirdly the villain of the piece, because I guess I didn't have the cinematic language to realize that there is nuance. Not everything has to have a villain. And I watched it this time and found her performance really heartbreaking. Mm. Like, watching it, I went, oh no, she is doing her best. It's bad, but she's got no one to talk to. One of her daughters has committed suicide and she can't talk to her husband because the priest comes around to visit and the husband only wants to talk about the, I think it's a baseball game on the TV. She has no one that she could talk to, mm-hmm. and wouldn't, I guess, even if she felt she could, because who knows what she was brought up with. So I watched it and went, oh no, I had you all wrong, Kathleen Turner.
Yeah, it's real. There's something both revelatory and distressing about watching these movies that you grew up with and realizing that you're closer in age to the parents and have more of, you're like empathizing yes. with them and understanding them. And you're like, oh no.
Yeah, yeah.
A meme keeps going around emphasizing that Jennifer Coolidge's character Stifler's mom was 38 mm-hmm. years old.
Jeez.
And it really undoes me every time I see it.
Especially because who's the guy who played Stifler? Sean Michael Patrick Thomas Flannery Skeet, you know, Everett. I don't care. He was probably like 25.
and looked every year of it.
Yeah.
Yes.
The thing that really got me, and I what I rarely do is do anything beyond just watch the movie, but I listened to a couple of podcasts about this one, and there was a podcast called Beyond the Screenplay where they talk about this movie, and there were four hosts, so my likelihood of being able to nail down whose quote this was is 0%. But they said this thing that really struck me, that really also kind of articulates what has struck me about Sofia Coppola throughout her entire career, which is, if film is a language, auteurs have their own dialect. Mm. And that really, like, I was like, oh, like, that's what I, you know, and that's a thing that, like, you know, the more you watch stuff, but, like, you don't necessarily, unless you're consciously going, like, okay, like, what is the flavor of this person's movies? You know, hers are always just like, hanging around in a dream. Like, that's kind of what it feels like in one way or another to me. And I have not read the Eugenides book, so I can't draw from that. But what this movie does, at least presumably with the text that it's provided, it feels so timely because it's telling the story of this, the tragedy that, you know, befalls these girls. It seems like the girls are the main characters of the movie or of the story, and they kind of are the main characters or the story, but, like, there's a real mystery about who they are, what drove them, why they did what they did. And really, it's about these girls through the lens of, like, everyone around them who either, like, had some take on them or objectified them or whatever. And we're getting these pieces of people's memory. And then we have these guys who are essentially, and this, I understand this to be more from the book, but we get these hints in the movie, these guys who are essentially like collectors of memories and ephemera of mm-hmm. these women. So it feels super true crimey in the way that, like, we have been in the, you know, maybe decade of all true crime everything. I found it fascinating. And then also just, like, all of these choices on Coppola's part that required the confidence of being Sofia Coppola, which is, like, sometimes it's an interview, like it's a documentary, and sometimes it's a movie where we're, like, observing people like you would in a movie. And sometimes we're, like, it's confidence and it's constant shift in perspective really took me by surprise. But yeah, what do you make of the, like, it seems like the narrator, the collective narrator, as we know them, they don't have a life outside of being obsessed with this story from their childhood, which is really fascinating.
Well, or it's like we kind of know them only through this.
Yeah.
And it's the sort of accidental self-portrait that you get. I have Norman Mailer's Marilyn in front of me, which feels pretty apropos. Let me read you the first paragraph of Norman Mailer's book about Marilyn Monroe. Why not, Norman? Why not? Okay, you ready?
I am.
So we think of Marilyn, who was every man's love affair with America. Marilyn Monroe, who was blonde and beautiful and had a sweet little rinky-dink of a voice and all the cleanliness of all the clean American backyards. She was our angel, the sweet angel of sex. And the sugar of sex came up from her like a resonance of sound and the clearest grain of a violin. Across five continents, the men who knew the most about love would covet her. And the classical pimples of the adolescent working his first gas pump would also pump for her. Since Marilyn was deliverance, a very Stradivarius of sex, so gorgeous, forgiving, humorous, compliant, and tender, that even the most mediocre musician would relax his lack of art in the dissolving magic of her violin. That's not about her. That's about him.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He really took the day off after writing that, didn't he?
Well, I just, and Suze, I'm curious about, because it's funny to think of, like, as girls the same age as the girls in this movie, watching a movie that's so much about, like, simultaneously being obsessed with the interiority of these teenage girls and wanting to know what's going on inside of their lives, but also being obsessed with surveilling them, essentially, which is the very thing that makes it feel impossible for us to exist as people in a way. I mean, what was that like for you to encounter at that same age?
Yeah, I had this, I mean, sure, I'm not alone in this, but I remember being that age and just constantly sort of willing myself to be more attractive to boys my age, which I'm glad I don't do that anymore. But I remember that feeling, and I remember watching that film and being extremely envious of these girls, because I went, oh, look at them. They're just constantly being stared at by every guy in their school who just wants to find out everything about them. How can I be more like that? When you watch it at 39, I'm like, oh, they're constantly being watched by every boy in their school who are constantly just trying to get in their heads and actually would have no interest in what was really going on in their heads. Because what we're watching, how I see it, is we're watching their memory of what these girls were like. Even with the documentary style footage, we're watching their memories. And like, how did they know that Lux wrote Tripp's name on her underwear?
Yeah.
They've heard it from Cecilia's diary that she did that with the garbage man or something. She gets obsessed with a garbage man and starts writing his name on her underwear. And Cecilia's written about that in their diary, which they've stolen after she dies. And they say, oh, she did that. So they've decided that she also wrote Tripp's name on her underwear. Yeah, fascinated with the 25-year difference of me seeing it at their age and watching it again when I'm Kathleen Turner's age or Jennifer Coolidge's age, and realizing, oh, yeah, no, the constant male gaze on them was very deliberate. And that's really smart of Sophia Coppola, who I guess knew a thing or two about that, having been blamed, as you say, for the failure of The Godfather 3 by being so bad and nepo and very ugly. There's loads of reviews saying like, well, she's too ugly to be in this film. And I
oh my God,
think it's horrendous. How does anyone deal with that at any age, let alone at 18?
It's wild.
She's too ugly to be believable as Al Pacino's daughter?
Al Pacino feels like some magic happened where people give him, I mean, I understand all of the sort of sexist implications of this, but I feel like people just remember 1972 Al Pacino and project it onto him no matter what is happening.
Or they remember Al Pacino and Jack and Jill. It's one of the two.
Yeah,
it really depends a lot on birth year.
Yeah, we're currently, it's like about once every 3 years, everyone discovers again the Dunkachino advert and goes, can't believe I actually did this. And then it has to be explained that that's Jack and Jill.
Oh my God.
You know, it's a lesson that out of even the worst conceived and executed film can yield a pearl of true something, true camp, I guess. Yeah. But right. And I remember watching Sofia Coppola win, I believe, Best Director for Lost in Translation. No, she wouldn't. Or did she? I don't even remember. Maybe not, because I think Catherine Bigelow was the first woman to win Best Director in like 2008, because women famously can't direct because we ovulate, to quote Kevin Spacey in Swimming with Sharks. But, you know, to watch her have a career at a time when really the received wisdom was that, again, women can't direct unless they're Penny Marshall, because Catherine Bigelow hadn't yet proved cultural relevance by doing something other than sci-fi, I think, and Blue Steel. And it felt so radical to me as a teenage girl to watch a woman who, you know, she was in Vogue and she was glamorous, and she had, there's like this Vogue story about her in the early 2000s that I committed to memory that talked about Angelica Houston telling her as a teenager that she had grown into her nose. And I was like, oh my God, someday I'm going to grow into my nose, just like Sofia Coppola.
I'm still waiting.
You know, maybe when we're dead. Sometimes your face just needs some time to catch up with the rest of your face. But there's something so fascinating to me about her making this movie about the surveillance of teenage girls. Certainly, she's, like you just said, knowing more than even most women about what that's like. And that there's kind of this implicit radical statement by being someone directing a movie who's really fits any category other than a straight cis white man, and saying that you have interiority that's worth exploring, that there's something inside of you and you can bring that to your characters.
Sarah, just so you know, that she did win an Oscar, but it was for adapted screenplay.
Screenplay? Yeah. Okay, yeah.
For that Lost in Translation?
Yeah. I am interested and kind of sad that I haven't read the book. The closest I got, I was telling to Sarah beforehand, was listening to the Sentimental Garbage episode about the book. Which is like,
you should read it.
I should read it, actually, shouldn't I? Like, yeah.
Based on the conversation that they, and based on your encouragement to do so, I really want to, because the conversation that was had was about, you know, is this book brilliant in how it treats and understands the objectification of these girls, particularly from at this time, like a young male writer, or is it creepy? And it lands on its brilliance is kind of in some of its creepiness, but its creepiness doesn't seem like where that's where it's ultimately coming from. Mm-hmm. But I there was so much I enjoy about the fact that like the ultimate mystery that we have is like, no one knows these girls. Like there's like this fascinating unknowability where we spend all of this time looking at them and no time drawing any conclusions. Like we don't know why they all decide to take their, like we can sort of put pieces together maybe a little bit, but we don't know why they decide to take their lives in the way that they do. We don't know about the dynamic of their relationship, which makes it possible to come up with the pact that they clearly come up with. We just know them from afar. And to Sarah's Norman Mailer point, you know, we see all of the things that they reflect in the people around them who are looking at them. Mm-hmm. We certainly get this really interesting, what, God damn, I should remember his name. It's so iconic. What is Josh Hartnett's name in the movie?
Trip Fontaine.
Trip Fontaine.
We do know, I mean, we do get bits of like, even the plot points that kind of seem to send the girls in one direction or another about what happens to them. Like Trip Fontaine becomes obsessed with Lux, quote, gets Lux, and then immediately discards her because he is, it was about obsession and not about her actuality. And then we see kind of her life and interest shift. But it seems brilliant in its ability to convey the fact that we leave the movie knowing nothing more about their interiority than we came into the movie. And, you know, it's, and this is a thing that Caroline said in the Sentimental Garbage episode, is like, this is ultimately a horror. Like, this is a horror story.
That's why they got those Midsommar type outfits.
Their homecoming dresses.
Precious ghost girls.
Yes, certainly the treatment of they leave a note for these boys who keep watching them with binoculars and a telescope at night. They leave a note saying, come to the house at midnight. And when the boys come to the house, Lux lets them in and says, I'll get my sisters, knowing that they're all dead in different rooms in the house. And then she goes and takes her own life. Mm-hmm. And the boys discover the girls one by one. And it is just like a horror.
Yeah.
It really is. You know, and like the fact that the motivation is ultimately potentially how we saw them be treated the entire movie, or how we saw, again, no one got it. No one got anywhere closer into knowing who they were than when we started. Mm. And we have that scene, obviously, near the beginning of the movie where, what is the youngest girl's name?
Cecilia.
Where Cecilia has attempted and then goes to see Danny DeVito, psychologist at large, who suggests that the girls are allowed to like hang out with more boys. And so the parents facilitate this party with them and the neighborhood boys. And the thing that kind of pushes her to try and ultimately die the second time is just seeing how these boys end up treating this kid in their neighborhood who I think may have Down syndrome. And she's ultimately, you know, sort of like moved and gutted and excuses herself in that way that like, you know, I've been in a number of social events and seen the dynamic and been like, I can't do this anymore. I need to get the fuck out of here.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you just go, if you can emotionally regulate slightly more, you just go start doing a stranger's dishes.
Like literally true. I had one relationship where my entire dynamic with the partner's parents was just like, I cleaned their kitchen so many times just to get out.
Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, that lasagna is going to be caked on. Time to edit that with the wire brush. It's going to leave you to it. Yeah. And there is, I mean, it feels in a way like a microcosm. I mean, there's a sort of, you know, I've just finished recording the Britney Spears book club with Eve Lindley for You're Wrong About. So I'm very deep in Britney headspace. But it feels like there is a sort of pop star is the political to American girlhood, where we identify so much with these pop stars, I think, and watching them fall from grace in a way that we as the public are often kind of orchestrating, or at least gently helping along, the way you might sort of help along an already unraveling sweater. I think partly because we see ourselves in them and vice versa. And it feels like girls being surveilled by boys in their neighborhood are just existing on a different scale than, you know, someone being surveilled by the world. Mm-hmm. It's just about scale. Mm. And like the more you get stared at, the more the reality of you sort of recedes.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah, we never see them look uncomfortable at being stared at. But again, that goes from this whole movie takes place from the point of view of these boys, now men.
Yeah.
Who say at the beginning, don't they, every time we get together at some corporate away trip, we'll end up talking about the Lisbon sisters again. It's like, wow, it's very true crime. Why true crime now? It's always been there. It turns out it's not just a domain of white women.
I feel like, you know, this is a movie about teenage girls, as we've said 200 or 300 times already. And coming at a time when the idea that teenage girls were worth serious thought or aesthetics, I think, was at kind of an all-time low. The turn of the millennium was not a great moment for girl art. And I guess in terms of style and images, I'm curious for both of you, kind of revisiting this for the first time in a long time, myself as well, if there are kind of images or moments that stuck with you through the years, you know, why do you think on a style level that this movie... Because a lot of movies have style. Sometimes some movies have too much style or style in the wrong place. But I think this is really a case of form meeting function. And I wonder about how that's worked for you both.
It's very authentic, as far as I can tell. Watching, it never feels like the sort of Tumblrification of... Was it set in 1976, isn't it? And the film came out in 99, so it's sort of the pre-Tumblr heyday.
Yeah.
But it never feels like, in the way that Adrian Lynn's Lolita, I think, is from around this time as well.
Yeah.
And that always feels very inauthentic with her clothing. It always feels like this is what a late 90s girl dressing up as a Lolita type in the 40s would be, whereas this feels like films I've seen from the 70s, they feel like they're dressed like that. It feels like their hair's like that. It's not too perfect. Mm-hmm. And it's funny watching it today with now, Kirsten Dunst doesn't have perfect veneered teeth.
Yeah.
And that I don't think we'd see that on screen now for a teenager in a movie like this.
Fucking everybody has veneers now. It's too much.
They do.
Veneers have become too available.
Yes. Yeah. And I looked up how much they are, not because I want them, but because everyone's got them. And I can't believe all my friends are so rich. I couldn't get them if I wanted them.
It's interesting because the thing that I did pick up in that sentimental garbage episode about the book, which will be my text from here on out, is they had made the point that all of the girls in the book have an extra canine tooth or have extra canine teeth. Mm. And so that imperfection in teeth is kind of baked into the actual text itself.
I see.
Which I think is kind of cool that was not just honored aesthetically, which I think is important, but also honoring the text in a fascinating way.
That is fascinating.
They also made the point that like mouths and mouth engagement from like dentists to retainers to just smells of breath, etc., shows up throughout that, which is interesting because I felt like I could almost smell this movie in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Like it's like an extremely sensual movie in the most literal sense. Mm. And I think for me, it was the first time this and I don't know when Being John Malkovich came out, but I think it was either before or after.
That was 99 or so.
Yeah. And interesting because I think that Sofia Coppola and Spike Jonze were either married or in a long-term relationship at this time or right beforehand. And these were the first two movies where, I mean, I've talked a lot about how I would watch like quote independent movies, but they were usually like talky, very sort of like dialogue stuff. And I think that these were the first movies that I saw as a teenager where I really understood the importance of style. Mm-hmm. And I really understood the importance of conveying vibe. And where, again, I haven't seen this movie for literally 25 years, maybe 24, 25 years. Mm-hmm. I could evoke the feel of this movie at any time. Mm. I could describe scenery in colors and vibe and the flavor of the sense of humor without remembering any of the text of the movie. So that that's to me is a really interesting feat. And it's a extremely welcome gift to be given as like a young person who liked movies, but didn't know what they liked.
There's nothing like it, is there? I'm sure there's a lot of filmmakers our sort of age who saw The Virgin Suicides at quite a formative age, and yet you don't see the style of it recreated on screen in films that are coming out now. It really stands alone.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you can feel things that she's pulling from, for sure. I mean, this in a lot of ways feels like Robert Altman's Three Women, which itself feels like a super stressful dream. And this feels like it's like a slightly in the opposite direction until it turns full horror. But yeah, this does feel like, and I hate to even say this because, you know, I want to honor the influences of Sofia Coppola, but also not be the person who constantly brings her up in the context of her father and her father's generation. But this like really does feel like the movie created by the offspring of the 70s auteurs.
Right.
In a great way. I mean, it feels like something where someone is honoring the sensibilities of the generation that came before her, even down into the era that she's portraying, while also very clearly being a person who at this time is extremely modern. Do you remember the time that you watched it? Like, I feel like there are a number of movies where I watched it at a very particular time in my life. And, you know, Suze, you spoke to this to some degree about like growing with the movie. Do you remember like what message you received when you first saw this? Is that something that you can still recall? And like, how has that changed since?
Oh, I can remember watching this at 14 and just thinking about it for days afterwards, thinking, well, what could people have done? And thinking if they only got there a bit sooner, which is to completely miss the point of the film, really, because the whole point of it is no one's been able to figure this out. And it's almost sadder watching it now because that's the fact. Like, this is something that took place in the past and they're still wondering. And it starts off there's quite a lot of humor in the film. There's this kid who declares love for some posh girl at the school. And when she goes on vacation, he throws himself out of a window, lands in a hedge, walks away. It's really funny. And it's filmed in a way that's extremely dry and funny. And these moments of humor get less and less and less as the film goes on. So that when towards the end, James Woods is so brilliant in this. What happened to him?
He's so good for such a dirtbag.
Yeah, did 9/11 break his brain or something? I don't know.
You know about him seeing the hijackers prepping for 9/11?
Oh no, is that what happened? Well, now this explains it.
Well, he thinks he did.
Yes, exactly. I don't know if this is a real story, but he believes that he saw the guys doing a dry run for 9/11. And that's where his brain just fucking cooked out of his head.
I see. I don't think he did. I don't think he could pick like Mohammed Atta out of a lineup.
Well, no, of course not.
But at least we'll always have his performance in Virgin Suicides.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, a lot of terrible people are good at the performing arts. It's not really surprising.
They are. Near the beginning of the film, he's obviously obsessed with planes and flight, and he bores these boys to death with this talk of how planes flew and war planes. And then towards the end of the film, you see him just sort of absentmindedly talk to some plants in the school hallway where everyone ignores him. And it's a really sad, sort of bleak sight. I don't know. I see towards the end of the film, it's like the sun doesn't shine anymore. It's horrible.
Yeah. It's very interesting casting. I mean, it's pretty against type. He's playing kind of what I think now we would call the Richard Jenkins part. And to the extent that I can see kind of themes and messages in this movie now, it's one of them is just how easy it is to die of loneliness while surrounded by people, you know, and then I think it did seem more mysterious to me, the sequence of events when I was a teenager reading this. And now you think about, well, you suffer this tragedy as a family. You don't deal with it, obviously, because it's 1975 and therapy is for the birds or therapy is about getting locked in a room and screaming at each other or whatever's the fad at the moment. And then these girls' lives get more and more circumscribed until they're stuck in the house together. And at that point, you know, it kind of makes sense, you know? It doesn't, I think that it's easier to see as an adult how little it takes to destroy the equilibrium of an adolescent.
Mm-hmm. Most of their records have been taken away from them. That's the punishment for Lux for staying out all night with Josh Hartnett, is to have her records taken away from her, and she has to burn them in front of her mother.
Very unsafe.
No, yeah. And it's really darkly comic. I suppose it's one of the last comic moments. She's like, no, kiss, please. Put it on the fire. She puts it on the fire and everyone's coughing. And then someone goes, what's that smell? And she's like, well, I'll just put the rest of them in the bin.
It's so fucking funny. It's like, I feel like it's a send up of Carrie, where they're like, what if like Carrie's mom was like, she was obviously pathetic in her way, but like, what if she just misfired? It's so funny.
What if Carrie's mom just had a lot less energy?
The Lisbon sister's mother, she has no riz. That's the problem. Carrie's mom has so much riz.
Yeah, that's so funny. And Sarah, you know what movie it reminded me of was Lake Mungo.
Oh God, yeah. Suze, have you seen Lake Mungo?
I haven't. I don't know this film.
Oh, I'm reluctant to even say much then.
It is a lovely Australian ghost mockumentary.
Oh, fab, right.
Yeah, I hope that you watch it. It's really marvelous. And Sarah was having a big time about it a couple years ago and then got me to watch it. And I loved it. Mm-hmm. And it reminds of that, Sarah, in the way that, without giving much about Lake Mungo away, is like, we have, to your point about like this being like haunted or burdened or driven to death by loneliness, we have that element, and it's like represented by the landscape of this house and this street. Mm-hmm. And we start the movie by this alert that like all of, I think the elms in the neighborhood are sick, mm-hmm. and they're going to be taken down so that they don't make all the other trees sick, which is interesting because mm-hmm. we're also talking about like the media representation of the suicide epidemic and the quote suicide epidemic with like teens in the 70s. And like as stuff progresses in this house from the outside, it just gets lonelier and lonelier. There's that also equally comic but extremely dark scene where, you know, the girl had jumped on the fence and impaled herself. And then oh, that's not the comic scene, but the next scene where they pull the fence out of the yard with their cars, and then it's sort of like just like metal flying all over the place, and it just feels like over the top and kind of sick. And then we get down eventually to this scene where Suze mentioned, where the dad or whoever had mentioned it, where the dad is outside just kind of like talking to himself in this empty and like sad landscape. It feels like that, where we're like down to just like a lonely house at the end. Oh God, it's so devastating.
Yeah, what life do these parents have? They basically flee their house and go somewhere else to, which is understandable behavior, but also it's like, well, what do you have now?
Yeah.
There's nothing. How do you live with the fact that it's all of your children? And that's fascinating, Sarah, you linking this to the Iron Claw, which I saw a couple of weeks ago, which, thank God, Virgin Suicides isn't a true story, but Iron Claw is.
Yeah.
How does that family survive? But I guess you just do. And I don't want to see the sequel where we see Mr. and Mrs. Lisbon survive. That sounds incredibly dark.
Yeah.
We did talk about in an upcoming bonus about Iron Claw and the similarities between these two movies. Is like, when Sean Durkin made the Iron Claw, he was like, I'm fascinated by this story because it's about the tragedy, but it's also about the refusal to grieve the tragedy and what that looks like.
Yeah.
And like, that's what we get in these pairs. I mean, this is the first movie in a long time, and the Ice Storm feels this way as well. Mm-hmm. And the Iron Claw made me feel this way as well, where I'm watching it and I'm just really trying to, you know, I was like born, I'm 40 and I feel like I'm the absolute youngest age, and this is just an approximation, but like the absolute youngest age of people who can remember a time when it was just acceptable to like never talk about anything. Like that was the expectation, is like, just don't talk about it. Mm-hmm. And even that's not true. I mean, I'm sure people who are 50 are really sort of feeling that in one way or another in a bigger way. But like this movie, the horror of that really hit me watching this in the same way it did with Iron Claw. Is like, these people are fucking going through it.
Yeah.
And the expectation is just like, watch baseball, play with your wing or whatever the fuck that is, sit in your room and cry, go to church, and that's all there is.
Yes. They send Cecilia initially having quite dramatically tried to end her life just before the film begins. They sent her to Danny DeVito's psychiatrist, who, watching it this time, I chose that to believe that was the real Dr. Mantis Toboggan from Always Sunny. I was like, that's him. That's Dr. Toboggan. Aww. He's useless. He just tells the parents, I don't think she meant to end her life. And I'm watching it going, I think she probably did. And he basically just shows her a load of pictures. There's what they call Rorschach tests,
yeah.
And then he goes, oh. And he's sort of all out of ideas. And he goes, I don't think you, what's he says? I don't think you have any worries in your life. You're just a teenage girl. Like, ah.
What did she say? Her line is so good.
Clearly you've never been a 13-year-old girl.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is the thesis of the movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And that felt, you know, very true when this movie came out and feels true now, hopefully less true, but I don't know. Yes. But that, you know, there's a basic sense of your pain not being taken seriously as an adolescent or as a girl particularly.
Yeah. I mean, can you remember heartbreak when you're 14 years old? It's, you've never experienced it before. So it's like someone's put a flaming torch in your guts and gone, ah.
Oh my God.
And if you tell an adult how bad you feel about it, they'll go, well, that'll pass. And you're like, well, it's not.
You're like, well, I wish I was as limber as you. And you're like, I don't care.
All right, you hard-faced mother. And we see Lux go through that. We see her get her heart broken and be locked in a tower with her three remaining sisters. Yeah, of course they talk all day and night and eventually make a plan to all disappear together.
Mm.
Yeah.
There's something remarkable about like the statement about gender generally, about the idea that the only way that these boys can get close to these girls is by looking at them through a telescope. Like they're a galaxy away to them. Mm-hmm. And then they say this really interesting thing in the narration. The narrator, by the way, is Giovanni Ribisi,
yes.
who she will eventually cast as a Spike Jones character in Lost in Translation, which is very funny, commenting on her ex.
Oh, yes. Anna Faris playing a Cameron Diaz facsimile, isn't it?
Yes. And so the line the narrator says about their memories of these girls is, we knew the girls were really women in disguise, that they understood love and even death, and that our job was merely to create the noise that seemed to fascinate them. And they're like imagining themselves in the roles of girls.
Yes.
Like even that scene where they're sitting in the room going through the journal, like it feels like an extremely feminine scene. Like there's a scene where you think one of the boys is going to like rest his head into one of the other boys. And he ultimately just sort of lands on the bed. But there's this like slumber party, like girl slumber party energy about all the times that they get together to kind of know or try to understand or figure out these girls. Cause like, it's really just, I mean, obviously there's the objectification and the end result of objectification, regardless of the reason, is still kind of the same. But like Josh Harnett is like really seemingly the only sexual boy. The other ones are sexual and like, they're like, if I could just like feel one of them up, one of them says or something like that. They're thinking about it for sure. But like, it's just kind of like, they don't even know what to do with gender, period, which is a really interesting thing. And they become obsessed with these girls. And every time they talk about them, it seems like it's like positioning them from like some inverted idea of like who or what they are expected to be.
And Josh Hartnett, my reading of it this time around was that his immediate obsession with Lux, when he just sidles into a classroom and she looks at him, is he probably sees himself in her, because the narration as we're introduced to her is, well, that summer, I think it says he'd emerged from puppy fat. So he's obviously shot up and got gorgeous over the summer. And it was to the delight of girls and mothers all around the town. And so he probably feels all eyes on him at all times.
Yeah.
And that was something I hadn't noticed on previous watches of the film.
And there's the heartbreaking element of the fact that like he is interested in her. He has such at the end of the day, what turns out to be an extremely shallow exchange, largely, I mean, entirely on his part, because they eventually sort of hook up and then he leaves immediately, physically leaves the scene and leaves forever. And yeah. he remembers that as like the greatest love that he's had in his life, yeah. which, you know, the punchline of which is that like he is clearly in some sort of treatment facility when we, I say punchline loosely, but he's clearly in some sort of treatment facility. Like life has not been great for him from top to bottom. Mm. But this idea that resonates with me in a way, particularly when I was that age where like you're fascinated with people, but didn't know why you were fascinated with them. And then when you got with them and had to like make some sort of reality out of it, you had no fucking idea what to do. And if you had, you know, Josh Hartnett 70 skill sets, I imagine you just literally like walked across the football field to get out of there, which clearly had a real impact on her because it like changed the trajectory of her relationship with that kind of objectification.
Yeah, and it feels like, you know, the boys in this movie don't really even exist as individuals. Yeah. You know, they're also part of a unit. And it feels like part of the whole story is about the sort of seemingly unbridgeable loneliness created between the genders in America.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a funny one. I don't think I could tell you how many boys are obsessing over them within the film, what their names are. I can't really differentiate between them. I know one of them has to go in for violin practice. So he plays the violin, I guess, but that's all I could tell you. And I don't think we ever find out which one of them is Giovanni Ribisi.
No.
No, and I don't think we're supposed to know. No. I think he's just kind of speaking for all of them.
Yeah.
And it, yeah, they're even less distinguished than the girls, which I think is one of the things that makes the whole thing able to stick the landing, you know?
Yes.
I also, I mean, speaking of Tumblr, that came up earlier, and in a way I feel like the aesthetic of Tumblr could not have existed without this movie. Yeah.
It's like 20% of it at least.
Yeah, surely.
Yeah. And like for people who don't know, like how would you describe that? It's like the aestheticized suffering of slightly chintzy, not chintzy, slightly fancy girlhood.
Yes. Yeah. I wasn't hugely into it, but I remember an awful lot of photos of girls holding cigarettes and contorting themselves to look as small in the middle with boobs as big as possible in some kind of floral. And that was Kirsten Dunst's look in this film. I remember very strongly being just like, that's the ultimate. There's a scene where a boy has gone round there for dinner, invited by James Woods, and he sort of hangs around in a bathroom and he smells a lipstick and it's incredibly, as you say, Alex, incredibly sensual. And then Lux comes in and she's wearing jeans and this like, what's that called? That sheared fabric, like vest top. And I just went, well, that's the ultimate look for girls. to be honest, I thought that then. I think it still is now, but that was the whole Tumblr look. Tiny waist, huge boobs, look very sad and maybe like you haven't eaten in a few days. I don't think it's good. Yes. I don't think the Tumblr aesthetic was good. And a cigarette.
No. We were very into aestheticizing not even the effect, but the whole lifestyle of having an eating disorder.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was an aspiration.
Yeah.
On one side, it was like exactly as Sue's just described. Like, I feel like it was like the aesthetic was represented by the fondest sort of heightened memories of 1976 as portrayed in movies from 1999 and indie sleaze as defined and by Terry
Kate
Richardson.
Moss.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yes. And Kate Moss. Yeah, exactly. Oh.
So it was like there was still an emphasis on looking kind of sick.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, yes. Absolutely.
The eternal Victorian. There's nothing, you know, more feminine than to look ill.
Yeah. Like you want an undisclosed malady. That's definitely the ideal.
You want lying down hot girl disease.
Oh my God. I hope I hope you do a sequel to your 90s show that's just called like Tumblr aesthetic.
And it's Tumblr just aesthetic. My show this year is called Class of 2000 and it's about our SATs in this country. They're called your GCSEs and you do them when you're 16, which I did mine in the year 2000, and I think Tumblr's going to be coming up a lot.
Thank God.
Yeah. It was cute. And the thing about Tumblr, I think, that felt so revolutionary at the time is that you had gift sets, which really hadn't been supported by other platforms. That was really like, that reigned on Tumblr. And that you could suddenly have this new technological ability to strip a not very interesting movie for aesthetic parts.
Very well put.
right?
You're so right that it's like, I'm now realizing that I have to go through the inventory of movies I think I like and wonder if I do, or if I just remember like,
or do they give good GIF?
Totally, extremely just like on point. You know, it's no wonder that it's a place that I re-examined a lot of my relationships with B horror, because sitting through that 85-minute movie is fine, but also mm-hmm. just remembering it in a great 10 GIF format is also nice.
Yeah, a lot of mediocre movies have great moments, and if you can harvest them all at once, then that's great. But also it's like there's something to be said for the journey, right? For watching mm-hmm. the first half of Lake Placid and being, I don't even think we're going to see this crocodile. And then, well, boy, do we ever see it. And I won't give away why.
I love Kathleen Turner, period. Mm-hmm. Like, full stop. Yeah. I grew up on Romancing the Stone. Mm-hmm. She was in War of the Roses, right?
Oh, yeah. Mm. Was she ever?
And then was blessed in my teens with Serial Mom. Oh, yeah. And then have her in this. And she's just was always around and is a person who kind of like occupied much different roles over two short decades, like in my memory, like the 80s into the 90s. Like she was playing like much different roles in the night. Like Serial Mom is a nuts role to be playing if you were Kathleen Turner in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And then this, like, you know, sort of conservative church mom is extremely different as well. But she's and oh, excuse me, I forgot her most iconic role of all time, which was Jessica Rabbit's voice.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. She just was around doing it, being great my entire childhood. Yeah. I really love her.
And Chandler's dad, when the writers of Friends didn't know the difference between a drag queen and a trans woman.
Yep.
Oh, wow. That feels like a very Friends situation. Yeah,
it doesn't on a rewatch, I was like, oh, it doesn't come from as like unpleasant place as I thought it would. It just seems to be like, guys, did you just never meet a drag queen or a trans woman when you wrote this?
Yeah. And they're like, well, No.
No. Kathleen Turner, everybody.
All the performances in this movie, I think, are wonderful. I think this movie is a classic.
Mm. Sure.
That feels right. Like, I don't think its quality is debated. I don't think anyone feels the need to defend it. Like, I think we all agree it's at least doing what it sets out to do, whether or not you like that. But I think, you know, it also shows how much of a movie can rest on the performances of the people in it, and also on kind of tightness of scope, you know? Mm. I think to me what feels in retrospect so different about this is that it is a movie with kind of a grown-up language of cinema, and yet it is about children, and it is about teenagers, and it's just allowing them to sort of be as human beings. And the fact that it's set in the past, I'm sure, makes that easier. But there's like so often when you're watching movies and media about teenagers, they don't even register as human beings. You know, I think that there's a real desire to make the fictional teenagers not quite recognizable as real teenagers, because if we were to actually do that, it would be so emotionally difficult. And this is a movie that actually does that.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely. And in doing so, like, I like movies about real teenagers are always devastated.
Yeah.
Like Stand By Me is a movie about real teenagers.
It's about real tweens, no less. Right. Like 11. Right.
And it's devastating.
Yeah.
Because you feel everything so, to the points made earlier, you feel everything so fucking hard with no context and usually nobody to support you. Mm-hmm. It's just like being an alien and absolutely unguarded and typically extremely unsupported. Mm-hmm.
And it's made by someone barely older than the people she's making the film about. Like Sofia Coppola was what, 26, 27 when she's making this movie? That's incredible.
Yeah.
And as a debut, geez, this is wild.
Yeah. I mean, are there many stronger debuts in Hollywood? I can't really think of too many. It's an incredible debut. Yeah.
Certainly not Francis Ford Coppola's first film, Dementia 13. Although I do really like that one.
I can't even imagine what Dementia 13 is about.
Oh, it's great. It was so Coppola was working for Roger Corman, I forget in what capacity, and they were shooting a B movie at a castle in Ireland. Mm-hmm. And Coppola was like, if I write a new screenplay real quick, can we just use the same location and actors and make my movie as well? And Roger Corman was like, sure.
Oh, bless him.
Yeah. So I do recommend it. But
okay.
But right. I mean, there's such a sense of things being so thought through, you know? Mm. And that's also, I think, one of the great things about debut films at their best is that they at their best can be the culmination of everything somebody has worked out to that point in their life.
Yeah.
And this feels like one of those.
Yeah, it really does.
Yeah, no one's going to be able to tell you, oh, they're just repeating themselves because it's their first film. So yeah, it's reminding me of like over here in comedians, the ideal is you do a show a year and take it up to the Edinburgh Festival and you plan your year around the Edinburgh Festival. It's not the ideal. It's horrendous, but that's what I do. But in many ways, your first show is your easiest because you can use everything you've learned in stand-up up to that point. And then the second show, you've got to start again. And that's when you do a bad second show.
Yeah.
Or if it's Fear Coppola, you make Lost in Translation, which is not a bad second show.
It's just annoying.
Is there anything else we want to say before we start to conclude?
Well, I really think that women can direct movies. I know it's controversial, but that's what I believe. And I'd like to see more of it.
Is the daddy question even appropriate to ask for this movie?
We ask it for all the other ones.
I get, yeah.
Well, let's do it. Suze, James Woods is the girl's father. Who, in your view, is the daddy of the virgin suicides?
I'm going to say Joe, the local neighborhood kid who has Down syndrome.
Oh, Joe.
When he says hi to Cecilia, it's the only time you see her genuinely smile in the movie. Oh. And so as far as I'm concerned, he is the one true man in this film.
Yeah. Oh, my God. That is brutal.
Yeah. It's a horrible scene, isn't it? It's like, yeah, it's really uncomfortable.
I am going to pick I don't think... Truly, I don't know who is acting with strong daddy energy in this whole movie. I imagine some of the girls are, but we don't know enough about them for me even to make that call. I think I am going to say, not because of the total of anything that he does, but like, I just love Michael Paré, who plays older Trip Fontaine. He through and through is like a tragic dirtbag. He doesn't do anything redeeming in any real way. But in a lot of ways, I think he probably reminds many people who watch this movie of their dad. Who like has some like Napoleon Dynamite Uncle Rico style memory of this grand thing that happened to them in high school that will never, ever happen again. And in reality, it turns out like even that grand thing is based on a deeply false narrative of yourself. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go with that as approximation for dads we regrettably recognize in our own lives. Sarah Marshall, who's your daddy in this movie?
It's Sophia, baby.
Oh, great news.
Yeah. I think that this movie has just a sense of security behind the camera, which I know comes from many different places and many different people who work on films, but that the style of it, which carries so much weight, feels so developed and so sure of what it's doing. And it's just, it feels good to be in a strong woman's hands.
Yeah.
Well put.
Yeah.
Yeah, good for her.
Yeah, it's crazy to think that, like, out of her brain, she created Tumblr aesthetic. Like,
she didn't even mean to. She was just trying to make a movie. No.
Yeah, she knew what she wanted it to look like, and it turns out it was the Tumblr aesthetic.
Oh, good for her.
Yeah.
She also, I think she cancels out any Nepo baby bitterness that I could possibly have because having read extensively earlier this year what she went through. Having been, as you say, forced to be in The Godfather Part 3 because her dad was like, must have my daughter in this movie. Oh, she deserved, even if this film had been terrible, she deserved nothing but good reviews.
Are there, do you have any more tidbits to share about that that come to mind?
Oh my goodness. I mean, so Winona Ryder, Johnny Depp literally called and said, yeah, Winona Ryder's pulling out of your movie, bye. And I think Francis Ford Coppola had like 5 days. Mm. And the studio had said, you must make the film within budget and in this exact time because we want to release it now and you owe us, because he'd virtually bankrupted several production companies or something. So he was ringing around. They tried to get Julia Roberts. They couldn't get anyone. And he then went, right, we're going to use Sophia. And everyone tried to talk him out of it. They were like, she's not experienced enough. She doesn't even want to do this. She doesn't even want to be an actor. But he was adamant. Man. And there are, as you say, huge problems with that script that are nothing to do with the fact that, yes, yeah, she is a bad actor and she didn't even want to be an actor. Because it's less than 10 years later, Virgin Suicides comes out and there's a panel and she's on it after a press screening of the film, and someone asks her, they say, how did your experiences in The Godfather 3 help you make this film? And everyone's like,
oh my God.
And she goes, well, it certainly helped me be less afraid of critics. And I thought, oh, I love you forever, Sophia Coppola, you have my heart.
Yeah, it's so, I don't know, there's a kind of a wonderful balance to her having been dragged to hell and back for just showing up and doing her best for something she never asked to be a part of, and then winning back the ability to be seen as a real person in a way by showing that she had thoughts inside of her, as all women have the right to, but so rarely get.
Yeah.
And then making a movie about how no one can see the thoughts inside of these girls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ugh. It's true.
And then making a movie about going out for noodles with Bill Murray. Yeah.
All right, everybody, that is it for this week's episode of You Are Good of Feelings podcast about movies. Thank you so much to Suze Kempner for joining us on this episode. Thank you, of course, to Miranda Zickler for editing and producing this episode. Thanks to Fresh Flesh for providing the beats that make our episode sound so sweet. Thanks so much to Carolyn Kendrick, founding and consulting producer. We really appreciate you, Carolyn Kendrick. Thank you to Alyssa Onofrio for producing little video edits that let you know about the episode that you can find on our Reels and TikTok. Well, you can find it on my TikTok at Alex Steed. We don't have one yet. I don't know why. There's just too many fucking accounts to keep going. There's so many accounts. We have to make so much content. Maybe someday. But in the meantime, find us on Reels and look at those videos that Alyssa produces. They're great. Alyssa's awesome at doing that sort of thing. If you need that sort of thing done, get in touch with Alyssa and Aria. Find us on social at You Are Good or You Are Good Pod. Support us on Patreon or Apple Podcast subscriptions. That's how we make the show. That's how it's possible. And you get those bonus episodes. So that's sweet. Now that I'm in LA full time, if you see a very tall, handsome man walking around, it's probably me. Don't be afraid to say hi. All right. That's it. We did it. We'll talk with y'all next week. Don't forget, in the meantime, that you, my friend, you are good. Take it easy.